Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to what I'm going to call an overtime edition of the High Percentage Podcast. Yes, no need to double check your feeds. I missed our Sunday recording, but I have, I think, a good reason. So basically, I had a really serious family emergency and I had to drive like 100 miles, probably a couple hundred miles in 2 days. And I just was out of town and I couldn't do it. But I'm back now and we're doing it. And today we're going to talk about game theory and how to play optimally given different rule set, because as we all know, rules determine strategies. What gave me the inspiration for this podcast and a similar post that I did on the site is last week I had the opportunity to get media credentials to go to the inaugural Kinectic event. And I did it covering it for a site called Grappling Insider. I've been doing more and more work with them, and I did a lot of live coverage that night, articles on, you know, the results, play-by-play. And I had the opportunity to interview almost all the athletes that competed, particularly on the winning team, the BJJ Fanatics team. So I got to interview Craig Jones, Gordon Ryan, Lachlan Giles, and then some other guys. Rafael Domingos had a great match against Gordon Ryan, in which he was really, overweighed by, I think, about 60 pounds. And he really gave Gordon a run for his money, had some good sort of guard passing opportunities, got out of some tough positions from Ryan, survived Ryan's back control for, you know, a couple of minutes. Ultimately, Ryan did get him. But, you know, by that point, Rafael had already, you know, fought an entire match that went pretty much until the end. So it was just really impressive work from him. And then Lachlan Giles pretty much beat an entire team by himself, four heel hooks and one armbar. And he was really impressive. And I know that, you know, real followers of the sport know his name and have known him. But I think, you know, maybe casual grappling fans, if there is such a thing, because it's such a niche sport, you know, maybe hadn't really had heard his name and it hadn't really registered as much as the big names on the Fanatics team like Jones and Ryan. But Giles was just really impressive. Not the biggest guy in the world. And again, you know, he finished five guys in probably about 5 minutes total. And I was able to interview him. Just a really nice, humble guy. And I had a good time, you know, working the event, getting the interviews, and hopefully we'll do more of that in the future. But it also got me thinking about how the strategy of games changes based on the different rules. Something that I always find interesting and sort of amusing is that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is unlike any other sport in the sense that it is kind of fashionable to either not know or not care about the different rule sets of sports. And the rules can get complicated in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu about the point structure, and it's, you know, it's not as straightforward as even something like mixed martial arts or boxing. And really, for a lot of athletes, the only rule that matters is if you submit someone, you win, because that is the one rule that is consistent across all formats that I know of. However, to proclaim that the rules aren't important or that, you know, I don't even know what the rules are, is kind of funny, because imagine someone in professional basketball saying, I don't really care about the rules, I just try to score points. Or imagine someone in professional baseball or football saying that. No one would say that, right? Because knowing the rules is how you build your strategy to win the game. And I think that the people that say they don't know or don't care about the rules is probably a minority. Most high-level athletes, even if they say that, a lot of times they're not being totally honest. When you watch matches at a high level, you'll realize that these athletes are acutely aware of the rules. That's why when someone gets their guard pass, for example, they're going to roll to turtle instead of trying to retain guard in a lot of cases, because rolling to turtle means that someone, you know, didn't technically get a guard pass and you might be able to escape and continue. And that's a great example of someone being aware of the rule and, you know, rolling to a position that might not be advantageous in, you know, like a self-defense situation, but in a tournament, it's the correct strategy. An example of how athletes adjusted their strategy to take advantage or play optimally under a different rule set is the Eddie Bravo Invitational, or the EBI format, which is that originally the overtime rules, they didn't really have as much of an impact on people. They didn't quite know how to handle that. They just knew that, okay, we need to train a lot from back control. We need to train a lot from spider web, because if this match goes to overtime, those are the positions we're going to start in. And originally, the EBI format, I feel like athletes really did about the same kind of strategy that they would in a submission-only tournament. However, over time, what you started to see was two things. One, athletes started to sort of run the numbers and realize that back control was a higher percentage finishing position than spiderweb. And at some point around like EBI 2 or 3, I felt like athletes completely abandoned the option to start from spiderweb, and everyone decided to start from back control because they started understanding that's where I'm more likely to get submissions. And there's obviously exceptions to that. Some athletes do like to start from spiderweb, but by and large, back control was the clear winner there. The other thing was that you did see some athletes and teams that, although they might never admit this, and I don't blame them, it seemed to me they clearly had a strategy to intentionally go to overtime, because what they realize is they can devote a huge amount of their training time to getting really, really good from these two potential starting positions. And then if they force a match into overtime, they're able to start from a guaranteed position. Whereas in the course of the regular 10 or 20 minute match, I forget what the length is, you know, they don't have any control over what positions happen. So being able to kind of like put the guardrails on that path and steer the bumper cars towards a guaranteed back control seemed like a good strategy for them. And again, I don't think any of this is a bad thing. This is athletes trying to win money and make money and win their matches, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. If the rule set allows for athletes to exploit it, then it's up to the organizers or the promoters to adjust the rule set. And that's something that major sports are doing all the time in the NFL, and certainly in the UFC and MMA promotions. They're always kind of tweaking the promotions to make sure that athletes are kind of checked, I guess. In the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu game theory course that we partnered with Gold Online to create, we took a big look at sort of the numbers and statistics for white and blue belts, kind of the newer and intermediate level competitors, and we talked to people that watch that course about the optimal way to play based on the high percentage submissions, takedowns, and positions. But another component of that course was to really look at the rule sets, particularly of IBJJF, and I understand there's other rule sets, but I mean, let's be honest, for most white and blue belts, they're probably going to be competing in an IBJJF style rule set. And if they're not, they really should learn that rule set, because sooner or later, it's going to come around. And when we took a deep look at what the game theory is behind that rule set, what we found was that there were a couple key distinctions that inform the strategy. One is that you only need to win by 1 point, which means if you are 10 points or 20 points ahead, it's just as good as being 1 point ahead or even one advantage ahead. And what that rewarded a strategy was trying to score the first points and then trying to keep your opponent from scoring any points. You didn't necessarily need to take risks to keep advancing and scoring more points, because you didn't really get a return on that. There was no incentive for you to continually keep advancing and scoring points, because you're going to win as long as you're up by one. And in some ways, that's what a lot of purists really hate about tournament Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I completely understand that, which is this idea that someone gets the takedown and then just sort of stalls. However, I hate to break it to you, but that is the optimal way to play. That's why people that do really well in tournaments have those kind of strategies, because they're doing the best they can under the different rule sets. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And also, you know, the IBJJF has measures in place to deter stalling, which is you have to advance position until you get to the two pinnacle positions, which is the mount or the back mount. So in our BJJ game theory course, we don't explicitly say, hey, pass guard and then stall. Like, we say you need to keep advancing, but also you need to advance conservatively, and you're advancing simply for the sake of advancing. You're not necessarily advancing because you want to continue scoring points, because you don't need to. And what we found from the data in our matches is that people that score first tend to win, And that also when you're in a defensive position like the bottom of side control, it's much harder for you to get back on the path of scoring because you have to first escape that bad position, get to a position like guard in which you're not rewarded for doing that. And then from guard, you need to sweep someone and then you can start, you know, getting on the warpath to scoring more points. So what we determined was the optimal way, in a nutshell, to play in an IBJJF-style tournament is at the outset of a tournament or right at the beginning, you need to be as aggressive as possible, and you don't stop being aggressive until your opponent is in a position that they cannot score points from. And what that essentially means is that if you get a takedown and you land in someone's guard, you still need to continue being aggressive because when two people are in guard, that's a position where either person can score points. So you need to continue being offensive, keep that tempo up. However, the moment you pass guard, then you can switch gears and play a more conservative game. And you still need to advance, but you should be strategic in how you do that. Because if you've scored a takedown, especially, you've gotten points for that, then you've gotten your 3 points for your guard pass, which means that you have a 5-point lead by then. And it's going to be a little challenging for your opponent to get back 5 points, especially if they're in a position like the side control or the mount or the back. So from there, you can kind of like take your time a little bit. And that's the best way to play that game. One of the challenges that we have when we're preparing for a tournament is that when we're kind of doing our nightly rolling in our gym, and this changes from gym to gym, I suppose, but a lot of times the nightly sparring is not structured to reflect the rules or the pacing of a tournament, right? Which is sometimes we say, okay, we're going to roll for five minutes because in a tournament you compete for 5 minutes and that's sort of good enough. But what we as athletes do is, one, we don't impose the kind of sense of urgency on ourselves in our nightly sparring that we probably should, because in a tournament, there is a sense of urgency. The person that scores first is more likely to win. I think it was like 65 or 75% of athletes that score first are going to go on to win their matches. And that was at a certain belt level. So please don't quote me on that. I'm just going off the top of my head. I know there's some nuance with this data. Also, in our nightly rolls, there is this feeling that we should be pacing ourselves, right? Because we know that in a typical night, we're going to roll for 20, 30, 40 minutes, whatever it is. We're going to do back-to-back 5-minute rounds, which is going to be very cardio intensive. So we should probably pace ourselves so that we can make it through the night, you know, without killing ourselves. However, then we get in a tournament and we realize that there is less reason to pace yourself over that long period because tournaments are not structured like our nightly rolls. In a tournament, you fight for a 5-minute match and then you get a bye round. You almost always will get a bye round where other competitors will go in. You're on the sidelines resting. So what is the optimal way to train when we're getting ready for a tournament to take advantage of, I'm just going to use the IBJJF rules example. I want to do other podcasts on something like sub-only or even like the ADCC or the team grappling formats. I encourage everyone to listen to your coaches and train the way that they advise that you train. But in terms of recreating the conditions that will exist in the match, the best way to train is do a 5-minute match with someone, preferably, you know, maybe someone on the tougher side, someone equal to your skill level. In that 5-minute match, you should start standing and you should prioritize takedowns and guard passing. Every match, you should try to do takedowns and guard passing. And even if you want to just drill someone or have, kind of a round robin of people rotating and attacking you, that's something that we've done at my academy. Have someone come in, see if you can take them down and pass their guard. The second you do, get them out of there, throw a fresh body at you kind of thing. If you want to do a full 5-minute match, you should take them down, try to pass their guard. And then after that, you should probably take a 5-minute break because you're usually guaranteed about a 5-minute break between matches. There's some exceptions out there, but that's the way they try to structure those tournaments. If anything, you're likely to get more depending on your bracket size. So you should try to maximize your energy output during that 5 minutes because that's what you're going to do during a match. And then take that 5-minute rest period and then do another 5 on and then another 5 off. I probably wouldn't do more than 5. That way, if you end up getting more than 5 in your actual match, it's just sort of bonus extra credit. But in that way, you're training your body to expend a lot of energy and then recover as quickly as possible. A good example of this is from the kind of parallel sport of mixed martial arts. And this is an example I heard a while ago. And there was a fighter named Miguel Torres, and, you know, diehard fight fans know that name. He was a WEC champion, and he was a real heavy hitter in WEC. He had kind of more mixed results in the UFC. But at some point, he switched camps, and he went to, I think it was Montreal, to the legendary Firas Zahabi camp. And Firas Zahabi is someone that me and everyone has a lot of respect for, and he really understands the game. And one thing that was different was Miguel Torres said in an interview that he was used to doing like 10 rounds or something a night, and he would just spar against multiple fresh opponents. But when he got to Zahabi's camp, Zahabi said, no, from now on, you spar once a night and you do 3 rounds, and then that's it. You don't get any more rounds. And I guess that really frustrated Miguel, because he said, no, I can do more. I want fresh opponents. But Zahabi's position on it was, we're recreating the circumstances of the actual fight. So you get one shot in a fight to defeat someone over the course of 3 rounds or 5 rounds if it's a championship, and that's how we're going to train. And you need to adjust your energy expenditure to fit within that 3 rounds, because right now what you're doing is you're training your body to pace it out over a number of rounds that aren't going to exist when you actually get there on fight night. Now, I don't know if that's the best strategy or not. I don't know, you know, a whole lot about MMA. I haven't trained MMA. I just watch it as a fan. But that's a really great example of a camp that, when they're dialing in and getting in the final rounds of a camp and they're kind of past the cardio or the technical improvement phase, they say, okay, from here on out, the name of the game is we're recreating fight night. And as you get closer to competing in your events, you should try to recreate match day in your training. That's all for this podcast. I mentioned at the beginning that I missed a podcast, or I missed our normal Sunday target that I try to hit, but I really try to minimize that. I want to be consistent, so expect us to be here every Sunday, and if we're not, we'll always do a catch-up episode to get us ready for the next week. Something that has been coming up as far as future things to look for on the site, I am going to do a little bit of coverage about ADCC, and I'm going to do it our way, looking at the game theory and some of the data behind ADCC. And also, I am interested in doing some more partnerships with other bloggers out there, with other podcasts, and I've even had a couple of people contact me with just ideas for studies, and I am very supportive of that. And if you have an idea for a sort of research project that we can do, all I would ask is that you have a really detailed process of how you would do it. You know, make the Excel sheet or write it out, and then, you know, submit it to us at High Percentage, because we're always looking for ideas. So that helps us, and then we can even lend some of our resources and our team to do it, as long as we are confident in it, that it's you know, it's worthwhile, and that the data would be sound and would have that integrity with it. And it will take some time to do, but we can help you do it. And we can give you even full credit when we publish it on our site, and then people can come to our site and look at it. So if you're one of the people that's contacted me about that, I'm going to start looking at ways that we can help each other, because more data is always good. And I want you to be able to get credit for it and use it for, you know, other projects or you know, your resume or whatever. That would be great. And then we could host it on our site and keep great content coming. Thank you all again for listening, and we'll see you next week.